It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the political fallout from the destruction of the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine. In the aftermath of the plane's downing, which took the lives of all 298 people aboard, questions are turning to how to isolate Moscow for its alleged support of rebel groups in eastern Ukraine. U.S. satellite images and other sensitive intelligence leave little doubt that Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was blasted out of the sky by a Russian-made SA-11 surface-to-air missile fired from eastern Ukraine on territory controlled by separatist rebels. U.S. officials say that ill-trained rebels likely shot down the plane by mistake, thinking it was a Ukrainian military aircraft. The United States and several of its closest allies have accused Russia of aiding and abetting, if not actually perpetrating, this heinous crime. The tragedy comes amid Vladimir Putin's broader campaign to fragment Ukraine and reabsorb parts of it into Russia. Some analysts have speculated that the downing of the plane, the concomitant international outcry, and specter of harsh sectoral sanctions by the European Union would persuade President Vladimir Putin to reconsider his military and political support for the rebels. However, it appears that Moscow is intensifying rather than diminishing its support for the separatists. The United States is accusing Russia of firing on Ukrainian military positions in eastern Ukraine from across the border, an assertion that Moscow now is directly engaging in hostilities against Ukrainian government forces. In addition, a U.S. State Department spokeswoman said the United States has new evidence that the Russians intend to deliver heavier and more powerful rocket launchers to separatist forces. Well, for more on the geopolitical implications of the downing of the Malaysian jet, we turn to two distinguished analysts. William Pomerantz is Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington, and Jeffrey Mankoff. He's Deputy Director and Fellow in the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Will Pomerantz, let me begin with you. There's little doubt that Russia's fingerprints are all over this crisis since it annexed Crimea unilaterally. It doesn't seem to have let up. To what extent do you hold Moscow responsible, and President Putin in particular, for this turn of events?
Well, I think the level of responsibility for Russia and President Putin comes from arming a group of separatists, rebels, mercenaries, you can describe them as you want, but a group of people who were not under their direct control. And they gave them a very advanced piece of technology, of military hardware. And when you simply give that and don't retain any sort of control over that equipment, accidents will happen. And in this case, it appears that the missile was fired, at least, from eastern Ukraine, and they didn't do the necessary analysis to know whether they were firing at a military plane or a commercial liner. And thus, we had this crisis.
And Jeffrey Mankoff, how do you see Russia's complicity in this terrible tragedy?
Well, I think Will is right. The Russian responsibility lies in creating the conditions on the ground for this tragedy to happen. And that includes not only supplying the rebels with the anti-aircraft system that was used to down the plane, but also more broadly, underpinning, supporting, fomenting this armed rebellion in eastern Ukraine, despite the efforts of the international community to end it.
And Will Pomerantz, is it fair to say that if the separatists had not received Russian military support, they could not have shot down this airliner?
No, they did not have the level of technology or the missile system to shoot down this airliner. So it's quite clear that it had to come from somewhere, and all the fingers are pointing towards Russia.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, now the Ukrainian military also has this kind of Soviet-era technology, and there's a plausible universe in which the rebels could have captured something like this from the Ukrainians. But all the evidence that we've seen, including transmission intercepts, videos, including the social media posts of the rebels themselves, would seem to contradict that scenario. And it makes it seem the evidence is pretty cut and dry that, in fact, they did receive this launcher from the Russians.
Will Pomerantz, back to you. Why do you think the Russians have continued to escalate tensions after the SA-11 brought this airliner down by sending more equipment, weapons, instead of de-escalating?
Well, this has become a crucial part of Vladimir Putin's policy. And I don't think at this stage that he's anticipating annexing eastern Ukraine like he did with Crimea, because the financial cost would just be too great. But at the same time, he really doesn't want to see an independent, democratic, economically viable Ukraine emerge. And therefore, in order to make sure that that doesn't happen, he has felt compelled to continue to support these rebels, although at the same time, it's unclear what sort of grassroots support now these rebels hold. And in fact, they've lost significant territory over the last 2 to 3 weeks.
Back to you, Jeffrey Mankoff. Why do you think that the Russians, Vladimir Putin obviously behind all of this, have continued to escalate tensions when this type of tragedy you would think might give them pause to reconsider this very destabilizing strategy?
I think there are both foreign and domestic considerations at work in Moscow. Will touched on some of the foreign policy implications here, and I think certainly the idea that Ukraine could become a democratic, pro-Western state, potentially with some kind of institutional linkage to the European Union or possibly even NATO, is a very worrying prospect in Moscow. And I think given the way that events in Ukraine have unfolded over the last several months, there is a concern that that's where the narrative is going, and that this intervention, I think, is designed to maintain Russian leverage over Ukraine as a way to prevent Ukraine from going down that path. But there's also, I think, a domestic consideration here at work, and that has to do with how does Putin legitimize its continued hold on power. Over the course of the last couple of years, you know, we've seen the emergence of more of a grassroots opposition, certainly after the December 2011 parliamentary elections, and then by the presidential elections the next spring. The Russian economy has been slowing for some time, and this year growth is probably going to be flat if it's not, in fact, negative. And so under the circumstances, I think there's a growing concern that the way of doing business that Putin and his circle have established over the last 12 or 14 years is not working anymore. And so there needs to be some new basis for legitimating their rule. And that basis increasingly has been nationalism, anti-Westernism, and the like. And so I think what you've had going on in Ukraine is these kind of nationalist flames being fanned to an extreme degree. And in some sense, by doing that, the Kremlin appears to have backed itself into a bit of a corner, because it's very difficult now for them to back away from their support for the revisionist, irredentist claims they've been making in Ukraine and still continue fanning that nationalist wave without having that wave blow back on themselves. And I think they're very concerned that if they fail to follow through in supporting these pro-Russian groups, then the implications for their own power within Russia are potentially quite profound.
William Pomerantz, to continue this discussion about domestic reasons for which President Putin is perhaps pursuing this strategy, we know the Russian media, the state-run media, has spun a completely different narrative than we've been hearing here in the West with respect to what's going on in eastern Ukraine, blaming everything, of course, on the Ukrainian government, the so-called fascist government, and so on. How is this propaganda playing today, even in light of this terrible tragedy and all the evidence pointing to Russian complicity?
Well, in addition to doubling down, Russia has become very defensive, and it has put forward a whole variety of different types of alternative explanations, but has not been able to provide any sort of real proof that any of them have any basis in reality. That being said, I think what people have pointed out is that this adventure in Ukraine so far has helped Putin's popularity as measured in public opinion polls, so that he currently enjoys upwards of 80% popularity in all of the major Russian surveys. And this, I think, to a certain level has empowered him, because he believes he has such strong support, especially due to the fact that, as Jeff mentioned, in 2011 and 2012, that support was not there. So this has really been a winning strategy for Putin and making his position seem more secure. But I think if indeed Russia continues the double down strategy and more economic sanctions are put into play, then the costs for this adventure will become more apparent. And that will, over time, begin to eat away at this popularity.
How do you see that, Jeffrey Mankoff? Do you think the costs could eat away at the current popularity as we talk about the potential for much harsher economic sanctions?
I think over time they could. The problem, though, is it's going to take time. I think the sanctions can, over time, erode the basis of the current political structure in Russia. But if the goal of the sanctions policy is to change Russian behavior vis-a-vis the crisis in Ukraine, then I'm a little more skeptical that they'll work.
Just a quick follow-up with respect to this, the alternative narratives that Russia is propagating. In terms of the population, are there pockets that look at this and just can't accept the narrative that Russia is promulgating?
Sure. I mean, there are still people, I think, who have access to outside sources of information and are not fully on board with the narrative that the Kremlin is propagating. But at the same time, what's been really striking is just how effective the government's media campaign has been in terms of not only building support for its policy, but also for reinforcing the narrative about what's actually going on, both in Ukraine and in the world more broadly. We can say, well, this is all kind of Kremlin manipulation, but there is an audience out there. And I think it's an audience that's much broader than perhaps many of us here in the West thought. And I think that has to do with the way that a lot of Russians experienced the collapse of the Soviet Union and what they see as the decade plus of humiliations that came after that.
I think that's a very fair way to describe what's going on. Putin is consolidating his power and using the events to do so. The question really is, while he's consolidating, to what extent is he also looking over his shoulder to see what might be gaining on him? And I think you've seen some very interesting actions over the last couple days. For example, the decision to ban advertising on private cable stations to go after private media. The decision, yet again, to increase the law on protesters, to increase the severity of sentences. And even his decision to allow Putin to appoint 10% of the Federation Council, the upper house of the parliament in Russia. These are all actions that can, on one hand, be seen as consolidating power, but they also seem to show at least a small level of concern that maybe his grip on power is not as strong as he might think it is.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are William Pomerantz, from whom you just heard. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington. And Jeffrey Mankoff, he's deputy director and fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS. That's a think tank also based here in Washington. And I'm your host, Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. And as always, we love to hear from you, so please send your email to us for an email, encounter@voanews.com. Let's talk about the potential for sanctions. And back to you, Will Pomerantz. We know that the European Union is starting to develop a more unified front and that governments could decide as early as next week to move forward with economic sanctions that would restrict Russian access to EU capital markets, maybe prohibit exports of militarily sensitive goods, energy sector technology, and arms to Russia. How do you see the Europeans? Are they overcoming their political divides?
Well, it's a little too early to say that they've overcome their political divides, and we will have to wait and see what this next round of sanctions from the Europeans actually looks like. Indeed, the sanctions that they're talking about would be more advanced than the U.S. sanctions that were imposed last week. So it would be very interesting if indeed all of a sudden the Europeans moved ahead of the U.S. in terms of its level of sanctions. Europe is in a very different position than the United States. It has a much higher level of trade with Russia. It is dependent still on Russian energy. So there are lots of factors in this discussion, and we still have to wait and see how unified Europe would be in terms of how it presented its sanctions program. But if indeed they follow through, as they suggest they might, then I think Russia would be even potentially more isolated if both the U.S. and Europeans are contemplating and introducing sectoral sanctions.
Before I turn to Jeffrey, do you think that coordinated sanctions could convince President Putin to eventually withdraw Russian weapons and mercenaries and end this cross-border support for the separatists?
only Vladimir Putin will be able to make that cost-benefit analysis. We just don't know what level of sanctions will be enough to be a tipping point to make Vladimir Putin change his policy. Clearly, Putin today believes he can ride this out. He, at least so far, believes that the sanctions would not force Russia to change its policies in eastern Ukraine. We just have to wait and see whether they're strong enough and tight enough and how much economic damage they actually can have on Russia to see if it changes Putin's mind.
Jeffrey Mankoff, please remind us about the U.S. sanctions that were another set of sanctions that were imposed. And talk about the potential for these EU sanctions. Do you see them going forward? Do you see the European Union finally sort of coming together and taking concerted and unified action?
Well, the sanctions that were announced by the United States last week are not quite to the sectoral level that the Obama administration had threatened, what they called stage 3 sanctions. These have been described as stage 2.9. And essentially, they are expanding the list of individuals and companies who are subject to various kinds of financial restrictions. And I think what's most notable about the U.S. list was that some of the major Russian energy companies, including Novatek and Rosneft, were hit with sanctions and were basically blocked from loans over 90 days on U.S. capital markets. And so that potentially has a significant impact on the ability of these companies, some of which have partnerships with American and other foreign companies, to implement large-scale new projects. So there could actually be a fairly significant impact on the Russian economy over time from these sanctions. Now, to get to the question of the Europeans, you know, we don't know. We've seen hints that some of the disagreements among the members of the European Union might finally be on the verge of being overcome in the aftermath of the Malaysian plane disaster. But we'll just have to wait and see. The Europeans have always struggled with, I think, two things. One is that their economies are much more intertwined with that of Russia. And secondly, because the European Union is made up of 28 states, you have to find consensus. And oftentimes, consensus means defaulting to what is essentially the lowest common denominator. And I don't think that that problem is going to go away. And the question will be whether the shock of the tragedy with the plane, in which a large number of EU citizens were killed, will be enough in the short term to overcome some of those structural obstacles that the EU has faced.
William Pomerantz, what about other elements of a long-term comprehensive strategy, for example, both on the side of Ukraine as well as sanctions to try to change President Putin's behavior and actions? Some analysts talk about we need to, again, these are long-term, you know, increase export of liquefied natural gas to Europe to lessen its dependence on Russia, open the door to EU agreements to former Soviet states, but also try to help consolidate the Ukrainian government and either helping with the military, but also promoting autonomy talks for eastern Ukraine. What are other elements that need to be taken into consideration?
Well, I think I'll mention an article that was written by Jeff's boss, Andrew Cutchins, because he raised an interesting point a couple days ago where he said, you know, this crisis is about to escalate into something very worse. But in fact, that the contours of some sort of settlement might exist that could at least diminish the controversy in Ukraine. And the kind of three areas that need to be addressed that Andrew talked about and are pretty clear. One, I think there's general agreement on that Ukraine is not about to become a member of NATO. The Russians don't want it. I don't think NATO wants it. So that's not about to happen. Two, there has to be some element of constitutional reform within Ukraine. And that process has started. And the important part of that is that some sort of power devolves to the regions. How Ukraine decides to do that is a Ukrainian question, not a Russian question. And the third issue that has to be resolved is the trade dispute that now exists between Russia and Ukraine, because Ukraine has put itself to find itself a member of two free trade zones. And that is upsetting to Russia because that opens up the possibility of goods coming in via Europe into Ukraine and then from Ukraine to Russia and being able to avoid Russian duty. It's a way around Russian trade barriers or tariffs or whatever. So something has to be resolved on that front as well, from the Russian perspective. And the only immediate requirement is that it would have to be in agreement with World Trade Organization rules, because both Russia and Ukraine are members of the WTO. So there is the outline of some sort of arrangement that could at least diminish the crisis in Ukraine. The only issue that would remain unresolved is the issue of Crimea, but I think that one is a long way off from being resolved.
Jeffrey Mankoff, to elaborate perhaps on that, and we still have a hot conflict going on, and what will it take for that to tamp down? Do you think the Ukrainian military should be reinforced, and what other elements need to be taken into consideration?
I think we need to be clear about what the end game that we're looking for here is. And my own assessment is that the sanctions policy that's been pursued up to this point has been a little bit vague. Certainly, I think the administration has been interested in imposing costs on Russia, but imposing costs to what end? And I think that's the question that eventually we need to answer. And that means that the policy of sanctions, our overall policy towards this crisis, has to be linked with some kind of political objective. Mm-hmm. And I think a good place to start is where Will was talking about what are the outlines of an acceptable settlement in terms of Ukraine's relationship with Europe, with Russia, with NATO. And I think we need to be clear about where we want Ukraine to be on all of those azimuths. And then in order to get there, in addition to the policy of sanctions, I think we need to be more effective at, for lack of a better term, let's say deterrence. And that means, to get to your question about providing military support for the Ukrainian military, as the president has said on a number of occasions, from the American perspective, there is no military solution to this conflict. There's absolutely no prospect of American forces or European forces being drawn into a conflict over Ukraine. So to the extent that deterrence is going to work, I think it has to be a function of the ability of the Ukrainians themselves to resist foreign interventions on their territory. So I don't think it can be one thing in isolation from another. I think you have the sanctions policy, which is designed to turn up the pressure over time on the Russian economy. I think you have to have a security component to help the Ukrainian military. You also have to have, frankly, an economic and political component in terms of the U.S. and European relationship with Ukraine. And then you have to have a political framework for negotiations where you can have a basis for negotiations among the different parties that are involved in this crisis that gives you some vision for how you're going to get out of it.
All right. Well, just briefly before we close, back to you, Will Pomerantz. Just real quick, the nexus between the separatists who want more autonomy and Russia itself and who the separatists are. Because if the Russians were not involved, to what extent would these separatists be placated by, you know, greater autonomy? Because, again, that would suggest that Ukraine can remain whole and still have a respectful relationship with Russia, with whom it has a shared history and culture.
Well, the separatists are, I would describe, as a ragtag group. There are some ethnic Russian Ukrainians who are part of the separatists. There are Russians who have been kind of transplanted into the middle of this dispute, and there are various reports of mercenaries who have arrived. So it's very uncertain that they actually represent the interests of eastern Ukraine. And indeed, they've suffered some significant military defeats over the last 2-3 weeks. So what would satisfy them? I think they want some sort of element of genuine autonomy. And I think this is where there's a real debate between Ukraine and Russia, that Ukraine wants to remain a unified state. And while it's willing to devolve certain powers, it doesn't want to devolve powers to the point that Ukraine ceases to function as a unified state, that somehow eastern Ukraine has a right to conduct their own foreign policy or print their own currency or conduct their own trade negotiations and so forth. That is something that the Ukrainian government simply will not accept. And indeed, that, I think, was one of the reasons why the ceasefire broke down, because that was essentially what was being put forward in the discussions as to how to end this crisis. So I think at this stage, the Ukrainian military, in many ways, has the separatists on the run. They have retreated to the major cities, and it is unclear to what extent the local population will rally around the separatists as they retreat. So I think it is becoming more difficult for the separatists, and it will put more pressure on Russia to see whether they have to increase their level of support.
And the last word to you, Jeffrey Mankoff, to what extent do you think that these separatists could be satisfied with a greater autonomy, and to what extent will Russia be able to accept that, or are they going to just hold out for continued destabilization?
Mm-hmm. I think we have to keep in mind the distinction between the separatists, the people who have actually taken up arms in this conflict, both Ukrainian citizens and Russian citizens. citizens, and then the broader population of eastern Ukraine, of Donetsk, Luhansk, and other areas. And I think the opinion polling is disputed because this is a war zone and there are different organizations asking different questions. But my sense is that the bulk of the population in these areas would be satisfied with greater degrees of autonomy, budget autonomy, the ability to decide a lot of important local affairs at the local level, protections for the Russian language, and that sort of thing, while still remaining part of the Ukrainian state. I have not seen a single poll that indicates that there's more than about 25-30% public support for actually separating from Ukraine. As for the rebels themselves, though, who, by virtue of the fact that they are armed and are carrying out this rebellion, have some say in what ultimately happens, it's more complicated. Again, as Will said, these groups are a kind of motley mix of mercenaries, Russian intelligence officers, and local supporters. And satisfying those different constituencies, I think, is going to come down in different ways. At the end of the day, though, I think if the Ukrainian military can defeat them on the battlefield, then it can address some of the underlying political grievances that exist among the broader population. And I think that is the goal of the Poroshenko government right now. And the question really is the latter question that you asked, and that is, how much of this is Russia willing to accept? Are they willing to accept a Ukraine that is fully sovereign within its own territory? And I think we don't know the answer to that. I think certainly we should try and we should be open to having a political process that touches on where Ukraine fits between Russia and Europe, but that doesn't compromise Ukrainian sovereignty. And whether or not Russia is willing to accept that, I think, is still very much to be determined.
We will see in the coming weeks and months. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director and Fellow in the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests, and our engineer was Rashad Smith. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.